Hello, and welcome to episode 156 of the Encompass podcast. I'm your host, Michael Sowers, Technology Innovation Librarian at the Nebraska Library Commission. Have you heard of SOPA and PIPA? Both were bills attempting to fight copyright infringement and online policy, and both have been postponed. But that doesn't mean they're gone for good. Brandon Butler from the Library Copyright Alliance and Director of the Public Policy Initiatives for the Association of Research Libraries tells us what these bills are, how they came about, and what's next now that they've both been shelved. This was originally presented as part of the Encompass Live program on February 1st, 2012, and lasts about 69 minutes. Enjoy!
Good morning, and welcome to this week's edition of Encompass Live. I am your host, Krista Burns, here at the Nebraska Library Commission. Encompass Live is Library Commission's weekly online event where we cover anything that may be of interest to librarians across the state and actually nowadays across the country. We do these, we do all sorts of different things, presentations, interviews, Q&A sessions, mini training sessions, whatever maybe, you know, come to my attention. We do these sessions every Wednesday morning at 10 a.m. Central Time live. And we do record the sessions, however. So if you're unable to attend one of our live sessions, this is a list of our upcoming sessions on our website. You can go and watch the recordings of everything we've done over the past 3 years. This is a list of all our recorded archive sessions. We'll have recordings there. If there's a PowerPoint presentation, it will be there. If there is links involved or handouts, everything is included there in the archive. So feel free to go and watch those if you want to.
We haven't missed a Wednesday in that length of time, have we?
There have been some that we missed. Just in case you're wondering, you're sitting out there wondering who the heck, what's going on here. This is Michael Sowers. He is our Technology Innovation Librarian here at the Nebraska Library Commission. He's going to help me with today's session, some more geekier questions on our topic.
Sure. That's the plan. Anyway.
That's the plan, yes. Our topic for this morning is something that has been in the news recently. SOPA and PIPA, recent acts, bills, whatever, that have been having a lot of activity about them. So we're going to learn all about them, figure out what's up with libraries. And what we have for you today is, and I should unmute, on the line with us, we have from Washington, D.C., actually. Yes, you're unmuted.
Inside the beltway, as the speaker.
That's right. That's right.
Inside the beltway. The terminology, yes. is Brandon Butler, who is from the Association of Research Libraries. His official title is Director of Public Policy Initiatives there. He's also involved in the Library Copyright Alliance, which is how I tracked him down, things that the Library Copyright Alliance has been doing in relation to this issue, and got him to come on the show with us today to help us learn what this is all about, in case some people may have vaguely heard about SOPA, PIPA, Online Piracy Act, what's going on with them, and you may totally know what's going on and just want to see if you're on track. You may not have a clue and are wondering, I've heard the words, I've heard the acronyms, but I'm oblivious because I just don't get it. We're going to try and do, you know, answer all those questions for you. And what I'm going to do now is we are going to attempt to switch over to you, Brandon. I'm going to make you the presenter, and hopefully we'll see you on our screen. You can go ahead and share your screen there, and we'll... There you are. Yes, we see you.
Hey.
Great. Okay, well, welcome, Brandon. Thank you so much for joining us. It was very short notice to get him on the show. I think it was the day after all the stuff, everything happened a few weeks ago. Mm-hmm. I started sending out messages, and you were actually very happy. You jumped right in and said, yes, I'm available. I'd love to help out, and that was awesome.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. That's true. I love to talk about this stuff. You know, it's a wonderful subject and a worthwhile fight to have. So I'm happy to be in it.
Okay. So to start off with, how about you could introduce? Well, I introduced you briefly. Talk a little bit about your background, what you do that relates to our libraries, and how what got you interested in specifically these kind of topics. And then later on, we'll get into exactly what they are. And what we need to be paying attention to about them.
Sure. So my name's Brandon Butler, as you said, and I work for the Association of Research Libraries. And ARL is, you know, it's a partnership of 126 member libraries, mostly in the U.S., a handful of Canadian folks. And these are big research institutions, mostly attached to universities, but also some standalone institutions like you know, the National Archives, Library of Congress, but basically big places that are hubs for research. Those libraries come together under the banner of ARL, you know, to do a lot of stuff, but part of what we do is a little bit of policy work here in D.C. So it's part of my job is to monitor these kinds of bills, to provide analysis for librarians and help you guys understand what's going on here in Washington, and also to intervene on your behalf. So, you know, I go and do visits with offices on the Hill, and we also write amicus briefs, you know, friend of the court briefs in significant copyright-related cases. And I work on other issues besides copyright, but for reasons you can probably imagine, copyright is really a core concern for libraries. So I work on privacy. I work on surveillance. I work on lots of issues about access to information that aren't exactly copyright, but really the core of our advocacy and our kind of policy portfolio is copyright, because libraries, you know, access to copyrighted information depends on a balanced copyright law. So part of the biggest part of my job is trying to maintain that balance here in D.C.
Yes.
Oh, and I'm a lawyer.
What?
And I'm a lawyer. I went to law. I'm a lawyer.
You actually can say I am a lawyer then when you're talking about these things.
That's right. That's right. I'm not your lawyer.
Right.
But I'm a lawyer. I'm a copyright lawyer, more specifically. So, you know, I'm pretty specialized in copyright, and so it's my business to really understand that part of the law. I cannot help you sell your, you know, house or get licensed as a super PAC, but but I can help you navigate the waters of copyright, hopefully. Mm.
And that is something that all librarians need to be paying attention to, copyright. Some librarians I know think that, well, it doesn't really directly affect me, so I don't have to, you know, it's not my job to enforce the law. And it's like, no, true, but it is your job to be aware of things that do relate to your job. And
right.
There's places like this, like the Library Copyright Alliance, can help us figure this out. That's great, so that we don't have to be out there all by ourselves flailing around and wondering.
Sure, and, you know, you guys, I mean, while it's certainly, I think all librarians should be concerned about these issues, you know, the library mission is huge, and it's also local, and so I love to sort of bear that burden for folks and be the guy that mm-hmm. makes sure that you're aware of what's going on.
Great. We're glad to have you, yeah.
Yes.
Okay, so let's get into what we're talking about here. A couple weeks ago, now these things have been around for a while and in process, but just a couple of weeks ago, these two acts that were put into Congress came to the forefront, got to be big news because they were up for possible discussion, and a lot in the internet in general, we'll say, the internet community got up in arms, and there was a lot of things that happened a few weeks ago related to these two acts, SOPA and PIPA. So let's start with assuming that, as I said earlier, some people on the line know what these are, some may not, some, and probably everything in between. Let's start with very basic, kind of like SOPA and PIPA for dummies. What is the history of these two things, where they came from, why they came about? Yeah.
Well, sure. So the origins of these bills, I mean, these are kind of the ability to go after websites and shut them down with the least possible judicial process is a wish list that the content industry, you know, it's been on the content industry wish list since the advent of the web. That is, they see the web as a kind of competitor. You know, we're selling CDs in stores and we're selling, you know, MP3s in iTunes, but the internet makes content available in other ways, and we want control over those ways of making content available. So, you know, the deepest origins of these bills is just in a kind of primal urge by the content industry to control every channel for distributing content. The more recent origins are in a report written by a woman named Victoria Espinel in her office. She holds the Office of Intellectual Property Enforcement Coordinator. And this is an office in, under the president, so she answers to the president. And her job is to kind of, I mean, there are apparently, you know, many, many parts of the government that deal with intellectual property, copyright. I hate that term, intellectual property. They deal with copyright and related rights. And Espinel just took office a couple of years ago, and one of her first, you know, her first responsibilities was to issue a report on the state of the law and things that could possibly be changed about the law. So we worked with her a lot. We worked with allies who, from the sort of technology and access-oriented communities to help try and keep that report as friendly to users as possible. And we did a decent job, but one of the things that was in her report that she issued early last year was the idea that there should be some kind of new law that would target websites that are operated overseas, because those websites are very difficult for domestic courts to control. And I you know, I won't get in too deeply into the details, but the bottom line is, it's true that it is difficult for a court in the U.S. to get its hands on, you know, a Russian kid who is running a website that streams pirated movies or whatever. And so that looked like a valid concern, and the IPEC issued a report saying there should be a law to change, to address that concern. And so the committee, the relevant committees in the House and the Senate, got to work drafting legislation that would respond to that concern. And initially it was called COICA, which I can't remember what that acronym stands for, and it sounds kind of like cloaca, which is the name of the bird, you know, where a bird defecates, so I kind of liked that. But they changed the name to something a little bit more appealing over time. Protect IP in the Senate side and SOPA on the House side were the kind of, once COICA didn't quite get over the finish line in the previous session of Congress, it was reincarnated as SOPA and Protect IP. And so that's where those bills kind of came from. Senator Leahy is the sponsor of Protect IP, or PIPA, on the Senate side, and he's the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, which is where all the copyright bills originate. So very powerful guy, very powerful committee. He, you know, he brought this bill forth with endorsement from the IP coordinator and under the White House. And so it really felt like, you know, this thing is moving. And likewise, Lamar Smith, who is chairman of the House Judiciary, brought forth SOPA. Again, with, you know, seemingly the blessing of the White House and, you know, moving on an issue that seemed very important to the rights holders. So that's kind of where these bills came from. But they sort of met, they ran into a lot of unanticipated resistance. And I guess maybe I'll leave it there, but that's where that's the origin of the bill, of both bills. And they got, and Chairman Leahy in the Senate got his bill through a hearing and a markup, and it passed out of his committee completely. So the next step for PIPA, as of the big internet revolt that happened, was that it was going to be on the Senate floor. Chairman Smith had gotten his bill through one hearing, very one-sided, sort of six people from the content industry and one person from Google. He had had one hearing, and then he was starting to mark up the bill, which is when the Senate, which is when the committee in the House sort of deliberates about whether they want to change anything about the bill before they put it before the entire House. And so they were in the midst of the markup, and that's where SOPA was when the internet sort of exploded and said no. And I'll leave it there for that.
Okay. great. So there's two different bills, and is there much difference between the two of them, SOPA and PIPA, as far as what they each say they can do or could do or will do? Or are they basically the same thing but on each side?
Well, they're very similar in their overall thrust, and let's see. This is a nice little chart that the ALA Washington office put together. Corey Williams is fantastic, And she put this together with a kind of overview. And there are some slight differences. PIPA came out first. And we all were, you know, we on the sort of library education access side of things were concerned about PIPA. And we had sort of said, well, whatever the House does, it should not be, it should dial back some of the problems that we see in PIPA, which we can talk about all that in a minute. Mm-hmm. But just in terms of the differences, we said, well, PIPA has various problems. And we heard that the House bill was going to be better, particularly Mr. Goodlatte. From Virginia, had, you know, he really gets IP laws in some sense. He gets technology. He writes a lot of technology bills, and we got assurances from his office that it would not be as difficult for tech companies and technology users to swallow the House version as it had been the PIPA version. And then when it came out, it was actually much worse. Whereas PIPA had been more narrowly targeted and seemed like it would not affect as many websites, so it looked like it was more targeted strictly at foreign sites and you wouldn't be able to get a domestic website. It was not limited to foreign websites at all. All the remedies in terms of shutting down a website, shutting off its advertising and all that were available against domestic and foreign websites. And sort of it went from there in terms of SOPA just generally was a worse bill than PIPA. And so that, I think, was another kind of strategic mistake that they made. Rather than taking a cue from those of us who objected to PIPA, the content industry, I think, pushed for even more in the SOPA version of this bill and got it. And that's what really threw the Internet into action, I think.
Yeah. All right, Brandon. So I'm gonna kind of play devil's advocate here just a little bit. I'm a published author, so I'm a content creator, and yeah, you know, yeah. I don't necessarily want foreign websites to be doing my, you know, stealing my stuff. So all right, but what? So why should libraries have a problem with this? It sounds like a good plan to me. And I, like I said, I'm being completely a devil's advocate here.
Yeah. No, hey, I'm published myself, not much, but when we're, you know, the magic of copyright is that we are all rights holders. You know, if you write a poem on a napkin right now, your heirs will be entitled to profit from that until, you know, for 70 years after you're dead. No one can use that poem without asking your permission. So, you know, copyright, you know, we're all rights holders in that respect. And so we all do have some stake in making sure that rights holders aren't getting truly ripped off. But the question with these bills was whether they really were targeted at the worst of the worst, the real rogue websites. You know, they were billed that way. They were billed as, you know, these bills are about really shamelessly criminal people who are, you know, taking advantage and selling movies and crippling our domestic economy. The problem was just that the bills weren't drafted that way. That is, you could be operating a legitimate platform. So let's say I'm operating a bulletin board type system, something where people, a blog platform where bloggers can post links to whatever they want, or a discussion board like Reddit or Boing Boing or whatever. And people are going to abuse those systems. Some number of people will abuse those types of systems. But some number of people will legitimately use them, and they will be sort of First Amendment platforms for those people who legitimately use them. And as these bills were introduced, they would not have recognized that distinction, which in U.S. law we have all sorts of, you know, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, although it's not perfect, does provide a safe harbor for platforms that do certain kind of administrative things to make sure that bad content doesn't get posted regularly to their boards. This would have been a kind of change in law from the DMCA approach, and would have said, if your site is a site where someone somewhere could publish an infringing movie or a link to an infringing movie, your whole website could be blocked from the internet. Your whole website could lose its advertising, could lose its PayPal account. You know, you couldn't take accept donations or purchases via PayPal or Visa or MasterCard and so on. So one problem is it was a really shotgun approach. The rights holders really took a kind of, you know, this was their opportunity to change the bargain that they made in the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, where they said, where initially they had said, you know, you can have a platform, you can open it up to people, and we will not force you to censor them and monitor what they say. We will not destroy your website if someone does something wrong on your website. They've decided, no, that we really would like you to censor what they say. We really would like you to monitor what people are posting on your site. And we really would like to destroy you if something gets through your monitors. And that was a real overreach. And so that was one of the problems. Another problem was technical. And so maybe the geek on the line can help. When you're not playing devil's advocate, you can play tech advisor. But, there were provisions in both bills that would have allowed a website to be essentially erased from the phone book of the internet. So the technology here is called DNS. And when you, so if I go, if I type www.arl.org, right, that gets me to the ARL site, and that's great. But in reality, that site lives at a numeric address, you know, 192, blah, 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 right? That's where Verizon lives, by the way. So the DNS is like a phone book that says that your computer uses it. It looks up a name, like ARL.org, and it looks it up in that phone book, and the phone book says, oh, ARL.org, well, here's the phone number for ARL.org. And this is the exact location of the server where the sites really live, physically live. And so that way you and I don't have to memorize, you know, 192.168.1.12 in order to get to the sites we love. And yet the computer can use numbers, which is the language that websites can actually, I mean, that web browsers can understand, to find the real website. So what Pippa and SOPA would have done was was basically tell everyone in the U.S. who operates one of these phone books, one of these DNS lookup servers, that when I try to get to, you know, piratefiles.uk, it's going to lie to me about where that site is. And rather than telling me, oh, piratefiles.uk is 192.whatever, it would send me to a government website that said, warning, you've tried to access a pirate site. This site has been blocked by the United States Department of Justice. And the problem with that is that it encourages people to tinker with the way their browsers work. So if my browser operates by looking up addresses at Verizon's DNS server, and Verizon is complying with the SOPA mandate and blacklisting various websites, and I'm a guy who wants to get access to those websites, I can actually pretty easily, you know, go into System Preferences and say, look up my DNS. When I make a DNS query, when I'm trying to go to a website, use this Russian server instead of my Verizon server. And the Russian server will give me the right address for pirate websites. And it might also, when I say bankofamerica.com, take me to a Russian mafia website instead, right, and harvest all of my login details and steal all of my money, which wouldn't be very much. But, you know, if they want it, they could do it. So that was the real security concern there was, you know, once you get people tinkering with their DNS, then it will undermine the way the Internet works in a secure way. And there's actually a specific technology called DNSSEC, DNSSEC, that is being implemented all around the country right now, including by the government, that would have been kind of foiled and confused by any attempt to fake DNS addresses in the way that SOPA and PIPA wanted to do. So it would have undermined an important cybersecurity implementation that's going on. So you had people from the Department of Homeland Security saying, essentially, this is not cool. You cannot block DNS. You know, you cannot muck with the way DNS lookups work, or it will change the security of the internet. So that was a huge issue. It's a shotgun approach. It could undermine the security of the internet. You know, it could attach to legitimate websites, and there was not a lot of process involved either. So if your, you know, if your site does get targeted by a rights holder, a lot of folks felt that it would be very difficult. So if you're a foreign, you know, if I'm operating a blog in the UK or in Russia or wherever, and I'm a legitimate guy, I'm operating a legitimate blog, but as is very often the case, a rights holder decides to knock me off the web anyway, because they just don't like what I've said about their artist or whatever, then I could get knocked off the web. And it's very hard for someone to respond in that context under SOPA and PIPA. So those were some of the concerns that folks had. One interesting example that I didn't hear until very late in these discussions that I wish that I'd known about was, you know, there are differences in laws across the globe, right? And so, for example, the United States has a really long copyright term, like as long as anyone out there. No one has longer terms than we do, I believe. And some people have shorter terms. So, for example, in Australia, The Great Gatsby is in the public domain. And the Project Gutenberg website for Australians, you know, gutenberg.au or whatever, has a free EPUB edition of The Great Gatsby. And if you are Norton Classics or whoever publishes that in the U.S., you could say with a straight face, this is a site, it's in English, Americans can get access to it, and there's our intellectual property right there, available for free. Now, that, you know, this is a legitimate site in Australia, but granted, it's violating the laws in the U.S. Now, there's got to be a more nuanced way to operate this, to sort of negotiate the situation, than cutting off all PayPal for Project Gutenberg, or cutting off all advertising that they might rely on from Google AdSense or whatever from Project Gutenberg, which would make the site invisible to Australians who have every right to access free copies of The Great Gatsby. So that was another concern is, you know, we're going to cause real tension with our foreign friends. And then finally, there's the kind of hypocrisy issue, which is how do we have Hillary Clinton telling China, you know, you can't censor the web, and our State Department spending millions, hundreds of millions, I believe, on technology designed to help people get around government censorship of the internet on the one hand. And then we have our own Department of Justice blacking out websites and our own laws, SOPA would have done this, and I think PIPA as well, saying technology that circumvents government censorship is illegal. And if you are propagating that kind of technology, you can be subject to prosecution. So, you know, that was another huge issue was how can we be saying both of these things at once? I guess that's a good kind of overview of the concerns.
No, that was wonderful. Absolutely. In fact, every about 1 minute here, we're going, you started to say something else, and we would look at each other and go, that was our next question.
It's good.
So one comment on the DNS thing, and thank you for, you know, I think from a technological perspective, you pretty much nailed it. The only other comment I would add is with your phone number analogy, you're not deleting the phone number, you're just taking it out of the phone book. So as long as you know the number, you can still go to the website. You just, you know, so it doesn't really, it's like a lot of other sort of security, I'll put that in air quotes, features out there where, you know, if you know anything about how it works, it's really easy to get around. So it's almost useless at that point. Mm-hmm. All right, so. Yeah.
I think you're exactly right. And that was the initial, you know, the initial response from the folks in D.C., you know, Center for Democracy and Technology were big early critics of this approach. And that was our main criticism of these sort of web censorship thing was, it won't work. Like, it's going to mess up the security of the internet, and it will never work. You know, if I can remember the Konami code, right, up, up, down, down, left, right, B, A, B, A,
yes.
Start.
Start, right, yes.
If I can remember that, then I can remember, you know, a series of 9 digits or whatever to get me to the pirate website. The Pirate Bay will just change its name to 192.125.whatever. So it's really absurd to think that they're going to stop piracy by kind of making it, you know, putting a technological barrier in front of people who live and breathe on the internet is really not a good strategy.
So speaking of people who live and breathe on the internet, I think it was now 2 weeks ago on a particular Thursday, we keep alluding to kind of the internet responded. Chris and I obviously know what happened. In fact, I did it myself on my own personal website, but what happened on that day and what was kind of the response from the powers that be?
Well, so what happened was people blacked out their websites. And it was a fascinating thing. I mean, it was a huge decision, especially for, you know, folks like Wikipedia. Wikipedia was probably the highest profile site to really censor itself completely. Google put a kind of blackout over its logo, but you could still search, right? They didn't make search unavailable. Wikipedia made Wikipedia unavailable, and there was a hilarious Twitter user who just retweeted everyone's freaking out, all the teenagers saying, WTF, OMG, where is Wikipedia? I am going to fail history. I hate you, Wikipedia.
yep.
I was following that.
So it was really, really funny, but also it got people's attention, you know, and it said, and it got a lot of people's attention. So there were 10 million or so emails sent to Congress as a result of this campaign. Several million people signed petitions. There were thousands of phone calls. You know, that's the kind of stuff that gets Congress's attention, when you can, like, melt their phone line. That really turns heads, and it worked. You know, I think a lot is made of the uprising of the internet, and that the internet killed SOPA and PIPA, and I think there's no doubt that those bills became toxic in part because of that and because of that blackout moment. And I think that a lot of credit goes to those websites, and a lot of credit goes to all the bloggers that did that, and all the folks that then said, well, so wait a minute, why is this blacked out? I guess I should call my congressman. So it was a huge movement, and it was, you know, the next day that sponsors of the bill started bailing. I mean, this is really something else. People, it's not surprising, you know. As I said, I tried to tell the story of where these bills came from in a way that gives you a sense that, you know, they were kind of inevitable here in D.C. I mean, our goal was just to try and change them a little so they wouldn't be so bad. It was really hard to imagine that they would just completely stop, you know, in their tracks. And so because it seemed inevitable, and, you know, Hollywood writes a lot of checks, and, you know, everybody wants to be on the right side of history, so when a bill is looking good and it's moving, everybody says, I'm a co-sponsor of that bill. I was going to save American jobs by stopping piracy abroad and so on. So a lot of people who really had no idea what was going on signed on to sponsor these bills. And then when the internet sort of rose up against them, a lot of those people jumped off of being sponsors. And that was a pretty remarkable thing. That doesn't happen all the time, because these are, as I said, also two very powerful people. Lamar Smith, the chairman of House Judiciary, and Patrick Leahy, the chairman of Senate Judiciary, you do not cross the chairman of the Judiciary Committee lightly. And they both were not happy about these protests. They both, even now, so I have, this is a speech that Senator Leahy gave just, you know, last week, saying essentially, I vow to continue to fight to pass this bill. We will not rest until the foreign pirates have been brought to heel. So these guys are not happy, and they're not, they haven't been chastened, I don't think. I don't think that Senator Leahy or Senator Smith, frankly, feel like, you know, oh gosh, I guess I learned my lesson. I'd better not cross the internet again. I think they are determined to pass something ASAP. And so it was about getting everyone else involved, sort of getting enough courage in the rank and file and the co-sponsors and the leadership to buck these very powerful committee chairs. And ultimately they did. The other thing that was really interesting, in addition to the sort of the internet blackout, is the statement from the White House. So there were two petitions on the sort of make your voice known, or, you know, mechanism that the White House has in place, where you can submit any petition you want, and if it gets 25,000 signatures or something like that, the president will answer it. Like, someone from his staff will respond. And so there were two petitions, one about SOPA, one about PIPA, I believe, or two that are about both. But in any event, there were, and they both got all the signatures they needed. And on a Saturday or a Friday, Saturday morning after the great web blackout, that following Saturday morning, so you can imagine, the White House had staff working late on Friday night. The White House issued a statement through Victoria Espinel, the person whose idea this was in some sense, saying that the White House will not endorse a bill that would undermine the security of the internet, that would censor legitimate websites, and sort of basically used all of the kind of criticisms that have been lobbed at SOPA and PIPA, and said that we, the White House, basically agree that no bill that does these things should pass. And that was when I think the leadership in the House and the Senate followed suit and said, we're not going to move on these bills. And the Chairman Smith in the House said, I'm going to stop my markup process. And Harry Reid in the Senate, the Senate Majority Leader, said, we're not going to consider this on the full floor of the Senate, even though it had been scheduled for a vote last week. Everybody kind of said, whoa, okay, it's a hot potato. We get it. The president is not willing to back us on this, so it's over. So I say it's over, but it's not. So that's what happened in the immediate aftermath of the blackout, is that, you know, things kind of got put on a back burner. But I would say it's really important to stay sort of vigilant on these issues because, and like I said, you know, the chairmen are not chastened at all. That is, they did what they were forced to do by their leadership and by the president. But every indication that I'm getting is that they still believe that their bills are great, perfectly legitimate, that they should pass. And so, you know, this is not over.
Yeah, I agree. A lot of the people who pushed for these and paid the money to make sure they got through, like the entertainment industry, I don't think at that level have learned a lesson at all. The report just from yesterday about the head of Viacom saying about how mob rule, it was horrible, it should have never happened, the whole stopping of these, I mean, that's just not paying attention. I mean, I think it's awesome that this, it was like seeing how government should work. The people said no, and the politicians listened to us. We're the ones that put them in office, and they listened. They said, oh, you don't like this. Okay, sorry, let's back up. Yeah. So they reacted appropriately. However, other people still don't get it, that if the people don't like it, there's going to be a problem. The way everyone, it's just the big picture of how the world works now. The whole world is connected so much now from the internet, you can't just sneak these things in anymore. We all talk to each other. We all know what's going on. Those of us who know what's going on tell the people that don't. I tell my mom, you need to listen and pay attention to me when I tell you about this. And that's how things work nowadays.
Yeah.
So both of these acts now have been tabled, whatever the put on hold at the moment for further review, for further working on them, or we're safe from them now? You said not really.
Not really. There's one other bill in play that I should mention. It's the Open Act.
Yes, that's the one that I've heard of too. That seems to be maybe an improvement that we were looking for.
And if I can throw in, there's ACTA. If you can maybe mention that also, which isn't a bill but a treaty.
Yeah. It's interesting. So there's a real So first, let me talk about Open. So Open is the alternative bill that that Senator Ron Wyden, who's been a champion on this thing from day one, he is fantastic, and he's a one man wrecking crew. And poor guy, I mean, he was alone on this issue initially. He put one of these holds. You know, in the Senate, there are lots of devices that allow for a minority to stop things in their tracks. You know, the Senate is meant to be slow and deliberate. Nothing happens fast there. And that can be frustrating sometimes, but in this case, you know, it worked out for us, and so we were really happy that Senator Wyden was brave enough to sort of be a one-man hold and say, PIPA is not going forward as long as I'm around. He threatened to filibuster the bill. We didn't see this coming, but Congressman Daryl Issa, in the House side, became his counterpart, who said essentially SOPA goes too far. Now we have no idea sort of what got Congressman Issa really interested in this, but it looks like he has experience. He's a businessman. You may not know this, but he's one of the richest people in Congress, and that's saying something because everyone in Congress is at least a millionaire. But he is a multi-millionaire from his Viper car alarm systems. And I believe it's his voice that says Viper armed if you have a Viper. But anyway.
Yes, that is him.
So Congressman Issa, I think he has had experience with trademark issues and sort of knockoffs and fake alarm systems. And he thought, you know, look, if the problem is that international pirates are trying to rip us off. When I was in business, when some foreign pirate was shipping fake alarms, we would go to the International Trade Commission. And that's a commission that's set up to adjudicate these kinds of disputes. They have, you know, they have experts in trade, and you know, the process is more open and less cumbersome than a court. Shouldn't this go through the trade process instead? If this is a trade issue, why make it a new copyright right that you enforce in U.S. courts? And why not make it a regulatory issue for our international trade regulators? That's the approach that the Open Act takes. Rather than go through courts and get issues that block websites, what rights holders do is they can go to the International Trade Commission and ask the judges in that commission to determine whether there's unfair competition going on, whether there's piracy going on. And then the remedies under the Open Act do not include DNS censorship. So that was a big improvement over the original SOPA and PIPA bills, was that there's no censorship involved directly, but rather that under the Open Act, if you win, what you get is just the remedy that advertisers and payment processors will not do business with that website any longer. So it's a better bill. It's a little more targeted. It's also really neat because it's on this website, keeptheweboppen.com, and there's a mechanism here where you can edit the text of the bill. And there's, you know, been 68 community suggestions, 36 comments, and so on. Anyone can go in and say, I think this part is silly, I think this part is too complicated, or whatever. So that's kind of neat, and we liked that, in principle, this moved a lot differently than SOPA and PIPA did. SOPA and PIPA, I mean, let's face it, were written in a back room with the content industry, and nobody on the library side of things, or on the technology or user side of things, had any access to this process until the bill had been introduced in a final form And they were marked up in a hurry with, again, no criticisms being heard, especially on the House side. So it's really neat that the Open Act is out there. There's a Twitter hashtag. You know, anyone who wants to say something can say something about the bill very early in the process. So that was a huge improvement. You know, I can't get into the weeds in terms of whether, you know, these remedies are universally acceptable or whether, you know, this is a perfect bill, but it is an improvement. And then the other issue that was brought up was ACTA. ACTA is really interesting. I mean, in a way, it's sort of too late for the U.S. on the ACTA front. I mean, we've already signed that agreement. But it's interesting because it's an international framework that essentially tells that was negotiated among countries like the U.S. that have very, very strong protection for copyright. And it sets a kind of minimum bar for copyright protection that is way higher than the current consensus internationally. So, it sort of sets a benchmark that says, if you want to be a real international economic power, you need to join ACTA and promise to enforce copyright at this very high level of stringency. And the biggest concern that we had about ACTA was that it exports a lot of the enforcement mechanisms that we have in the U.S. So it exports, you know, very high statutory damages are encouraged. You know, so that if you catch me sharing a file on the web, you can sue me for $150,000 a file, rather than just whatever you claim you lost, which is probably almost nothing. So those kinds of things, but it didn't export any of the limitations that we have. So there's limitations for libraries. There's limitations to protect access for the blind. There's limitations like fair use that are open and flexible. None of that stuff was in the ACTA agreement. So it's all about ratcheting up enforcement without any of the balancing factors that ensure that enforcement doesn't run amok. And ACTA is being debated abroad right now for countries that haven't yet joined in. And it's becoming a really hotly debated issue. Another interesting thing about ACTA is that it was not approved by the Senate in the way that a treaty usually is. It was just signed off on by the president. And the claim is that there's nothing in there that would change U.S. law, and so there's no reason for it's not a real treaty. It's an agreement. It's something, you know, something fuzzy. And that's all fine and good, except that, of course, ACTA will be invoked as a reason why the U.S. should, you know, continue to ratchet up its enforcement efforts and ratchet up its copyright protection efforts. So it's this, like, non-agreement that, you know, we never got to vote on, our representatives never got to vote on, and yet it will be used to change the way access to information operates around the world. So more kind of democracy problems, just like SOPA and PIPA, where you feel like there's a backroom deal that went down and nobody got to know about it until the last minute. ACTA is definitely that way. And in fact, literally the text of ACTA was secret until the last possible second. The only way we ever found out about it was from leaks, but no one could see the ACTA text until the very last minute.
Yeah, I have one other question for you, which I thought of because of this. I think it might be good for our audience. It's somewhat tangential, but libraries and copyright related, I think. And if you're not prepared to speak to it, just say so, because I'm pulling this out of left field a little bit. I read recently there was a Supreme Court case that basically said Congress can put things in the public domain back under copyright. Huh?
Yeah. No, I'm happy to talk about that. It's the case is called Golan v. Holder, copyright scholars that I respect have read this case to be essentially the Supreme Court saying we are not going to stop Congress from doing whatever it wants in the copyright sphere. Congress can do whatever it wants. If you're in the public domain, Congress can take you back out. If your term is about to expire, Congress can just extend it and extend it and extend it into infinity. So despite the fact that if you read, and I don't have, where's my copy? If you read the Constitution, there is, you know, the provision in the Constitution is fairly clear that Congress's rights, Congress's power to, here we go, Congress's power to legislate on the subject of, that's the highlighted part, Congress's power to legislate on the subject of copyright is limited to promote progress in science and the useful arts, and they can only assure a copyright monopoly for limited times. And what the court said was essentially, we will never strike down a law simply because it will not promote progress and it does not appropriately limit the term of copyright. So it's sort of all bets are off now. Larry Lessig had a great little post about this at thenation.com, where he said essentially, you know, the Golan decision came out on the same day as the SOPA bill was put on hold. And so it was a sort of a weird, like, people have the power to stop things, but the court has no power. So the way to change the law or to stop the law from getting worse is exclusively through advocacy and the internet and lobbying and going to Congress and asking them to do the right thing, because the court now has said, we will not stop Congress from legislating in the copyright arena. There's just nothing Congress can't do. So it's really, it stinks. I mean, we had tried to argue that, you know, once something is in the public domain, it belongs to us, and you can't take it away from us willy-nilly, in the same way that, you know, if they took away copyrights from rights holders, you can bet there would be a lawsuit about that, that once we have a copyright, you know, you can't sort of strip it from us. We have a right, and it belongs to us. So it was a sad decision, but not totally unpredictable. I would commend people to read Justice Breyer's dissent in the Golan case, though. It's a really fantastic survey of the history of copyright law, why copyright is meant to promote progress and not just to sort of incur, not just to secure permanent profits for people who own rights. So Breyer's dissent is really, really good. You can skip the majority opinion. It's not very good.
Yeah, as I've said in some presentations, I probably got this from somewhere else, the Constitution doesn't say that Congress can promote can create copyright law to protect your business model. Yep. All right.
So anyone, I haven't had any questions yet from the audience, so we've just been kind of listening and talking ourselves here. If anyone out there, you do have any questions, comments, anything, like I said, type them into the questions section of your GoToWebinar interface. We are about 5 minutes left of our time here. We started about 5 after, so that's fine. So if you do, feel free to type them in there. I think we've gotten a lot of great, everything we wanted out of this. As Michael said, every time we thought of, don't forget to ask him about that, then you mentioned it anyways.
So. And you got a little round of clapping from us where you said, where's my copy of the Constitution? It's right over here. So, yes. You know. That's just...
Everybody should be able to do that. Let me get my copy of that out for you.
You got to keep that on hand.
Yeah.
Absolutely. When we were working on, one just little final thing that I know of, that when we were working on getting you on the show here, there was a little delay of getting back and forth with you because you were actually working on something that I might want to have you mention, the Code of Best Practices in Fair Use that guys at ARL had just come out with after, from what you told me, 2 years worth of hard work.
That's right, yeah. It's my pleasure to talk about that.
please, you did this for us.
Yeah.
Go right ahead.
Something at library.
All right, yeah, it's by, for, and about all of you. This is the website. This is the long version, but just go to arl.org/fair use, and it'll point you to this. And this page is the home for the Code of Best Practices in Fair Use for Academic and Research Libraries. And the code is a document that we've been working for 2 years to put it together. It's one of many codes. Let's see if I can just pull it up. So it's one of many codes that the Center for Social Media Pat Alterheide and Peter Yazzie at American University have helped to facilitate these codes of best practices in fair use. And the idea here is that fair use is a really flexible document, a really flexible doctrine. It's meant to be that way. It's meant to evolve and change over time. It's meant to accommodate new practices. And it's also meant to be sort of shaped to different communities of practice. That is, what is fair for a librarian is not going to be the same kinds of practices as are fair for a journalist. Every community can kind of generate its own norms based on its own mission and its own values. And so what we've done for the last 2 years is talk to the library community and find out, first of all, where were the issues of copyright and fair use giving people heartburn? And those, we collected that in a report that we issued that sort of talks about the challenges that people are facing. And that came out a year ago. And then based on those challenges, we went out and we talked to librarians in small focus groups and said, well, how can fair use be helpful in meeting those challenges? And so that's really what this document is. It is the result of those focus groups. We spoke with nearly 100 librarians across 10 or so focus groups. So we spent, and each focus group was about 4 hours. So it's 40 hours of deliberation across, librarians from all different kinds of institutions, serving all different kinds of roles, but looking at these scenarios and saying, with some guidance from me and from Peter Yazzie, who we're both copyright lawyers, and Peter is a fair use expert, with some guidance from us in terms of what is the background of fair use and the basic principles of fair use, but then applying those fair use principles as a librarian, what are the situations where fair use could be helpful? And so we just walk through those situations in the code. It's really, really, we hope it'll be really clear for you guys which situations where fair use can be helpful. And each situation is described in a principle like this one that's kind of a broad. It is fair use for a library to do thus and such. But then each principle is qualified by some limitations that came out in the panels that said, well, yes, but libraries should keep these limitations in mind and don't go too far. So these are kind of, you can do this, but these are the nuances that you should keep in mind as you go forward. And there's a lot of guidance out there for libraries on fair use and on copyright in general, but we hope that this will be useful because it's not meant to give you arbitrary, rigid guidelines like 10 pages or 10%. It gives you these sort of principles that you can apply from situation to situation and help you think through for yourself how to answer these questions sort of one issue at a time. And it came from the library community. So there's a lot of people, I won't name any names, Copyright Clearance Center, who put out information about copyright who they benefit when you are scared. They make money when you, rather than doing fair use, you pay a license. And so, I'm always a little dubious about how much can you trust those folks when they're telling you what you can do. But this document comes from the library community. So hopefully it presents values that are going to be familiar to you, that will sound right because it's written by your peers, and that they have your best interests at heart as librarians. So that's the code, and we're out there barnstorming for this thing. I'm sort of traveling the country over the next month and a half. Every week I'm in a different, two or three different cities. So hopefully look out for an event somewhere near you sometime in the next few months.
Well, it looks like we just caught you just in time to get you on our show then. Going to be out and about.
Yeah, that's right. I'm not going to be much fun to find in the next month and a half.
Yeah, it was interesting you mentioned the Copyright Clearance Center. I do listen to their podcast on a regular basis, and yeah, if I didn't I read a lot about these issues. I present on them periodically. And if I didn't do that, just listening to their podcast, yeah, I'd be scared to do anything. So I see where you're coming from on that one. You know, it's license, 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 license. And I'm yes. like, just once I want them to say fair use. You know, just once.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of bad information out there about fair use, not just from people like CCC. Even good-hearted, well-meaning people will just repeat what they heard, you know, at a conference somewhere from somebody. And our goal with this code is not just to sort of give people a reliable, one reliable document, but actually to give a whole host of resources. So if you go to the Fair Use website, you will find not just the code, but over here in the right-hand column, we have, there's a blog post that I wrote about the code that kind of gives even more context. And then we have videos of webcasts that we've given about the code. We have a video that has me doing a lot of this and explaining fair use. We have FAQs, which I think, you know, these are really, it's been ever since I first started working at ARL a few years ago, it's been my goal to write up our own FAQ on fair use, because there are so many bad ones out there and so many sort of fear-mongering ones that I hope it would be helpful to look at this basic information and maybe get an antidote to the bad stuff that's out there. So I would really encourage you to look at all that kind of stuff that we have available. In addition to the code, all these FAQs, we have little briefing documents. We talk about accessibility, cost of conservatism, and we actually, this further info is not a very helpful name for it. It's actually really good stuff. If you're a real copyright geek, it's a series of law review articles that are really important for the way we think about fair use. So if you want to dig super deep, these resources are helpful.
Great. Cool. Yeah, no, I'm kind of one of those copyright geeks, so I might take a look at that.
So the title
dig in.
The title of the actual document is for academic and research libraries. How appropriate would this be for someone at a public librarian to be able to use?
Yeah, your mileage may vary when you get beyond that context of academic and research, because the focus groups that I talked about were really focused on, were comprised of academic and research libraries, and the principles, if you look at them, are kind of mostly about supporting pretty hardcore research type stuff. So it's about preserving special collections. It's about mass digitization to facilitate search. You know, there's a lot of stuff in there that's probably not going to be so helpful. And again, it wasn't written by school librarians who are in a slightly different context, or public librarians. So, you know, the value in terms of, are these your peers? Are these people that know what it's like to do what you do? Could be a little bit lower there. But you know, I'm a big believer in checking out every resource that there is, and if the school librarians and the public librarians want to look it over and see what might help them, you know, I think it can't hurt.
Absolutely, yeah. All the information you can get doesn't hurt.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it doesn't look like we got any other questions or comments. We must have either told them everything they ever wanted to know about SOPA and PIPA and OPEN, or they're stunned
lost.
And don't have and are just shocked into silence. Either way, it works. So that's good. The session has been recorded, though, so people will go listen to it later. And, of course, contact us if you have more and more information. Brandon is, of course, available. All of these links that she had on here we will include when we put the recording up. And if there's anything else you want us to make sure we share with people, Brandon, just shoot me an email, and I'll make sure I add it to our delicious links so that everyone has the appropriate resources they need know all about this.
Great.
Yeah. Any last things you want to say before we do wrap up?
You know, one point I didn't get to make, and I'll make sure that this link gets in the delicious wrap up, is that the fundamental assumption behind all of these laws is that the copyright industries are struggling. You know, there's an idea that, look, if the Martians are invading, you know, if mass death is at hand, then if we have to break a few eggs to make an omelet, it's worth it, right? If we have to censor the web to prevent the apocalypse, you know, censor the web. And so one thing that I think would be really helpful is if folks really understood the real state of the entertainment industry and whether it's really under attack, whether they're really suffering and dying because of piracy. It's a discussion that, frankly, we can't have here in the Capitol yet. I mean, people look at me like I have three heads if I say the entertainment industry is really not doing that badly and piracy is really not a huge issue. Of course it's a huge issue. But anyway, so this website, techdirt.com, is a fantastic source generally. And then this Sky is Rising report that they just put out is a really interesting survey of, you know, how is the entertainment industry really doing right now and what's going on out there. So that's one thing I'd say if you really want to dig deep on this issue, that's a good place to start.
Yeah, and as Michael mentioned earlier.
That's it. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, when he was talking about himself as an author, if you listen to what the industry says compared to what the actual content creators themselves say, the authors and the writers and the musicians, it's a different story. Yeah.
That's right. That's a huge theme here is really what's going on is the people who you used to have to go to for permission to put out a record are losing money. But now you can put it out yourself, and then you can make the money instead.
Yeah, and that may be what the entertainment industry and them, those middlemen are afraid of. They're not needed anymore.
Exactly.
Mm. Well, all right. Well, thank you so much, Brandon. This was great.
Yeah, this was wonderful.
I'm going to steal back control now.
All right.
And should be show our screen back here for a second.
Hey, we're still here.
Yeah, we're still here. So, yes, and as I said, thank you so much for being here with us today. It was an awesome session. And Michael and I have been conspiring behind the scenes here on ideas of other times when we can possibly bring you back on the show to talk about some of these other issues. So be prepared for, you know, after you're done with your travels. Yeah, don't worry. So thank you very much, everyone. And that will wrap it up for today's Encompass Live. And I just want to say I hope you join us next week when we are on a totally different topic, as we usually do here. Our topic next week I hope you join us for is Learning for Life, AASL Standards for the 21st Century Learner. This would be one for the school librarians out there. Just bring it up on my, what am I doing here? American Association of School Librarians has their Learning for Life standards, which relate to 21st century standards, and we've got a group of librarians that are going to be coming on to talk to us about that next week. So sign up and join us for that if you are a school librarian or you just want to, as we were talking about here, use what they use in your library. You know, all these concepts can be possibly modified and used across the board. So thank you very much for attending. And this is a great show, and hopefully we will see you next time on Encompass Live.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Encompass Podcast, a production of the Nebraska Library Commission in Lincoln, Nebraska. To find out more about the commission and this podcast, visit our blog at www.nlc.state.ne.us/blogs/NLC. Have a great day.